You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
This is Kristen Farrick for The Art World Demystified, and I'm here with Eric Hanospel, Special Projects Coordinator for ArtCast, Canada's premier art foundry, founded in 1964. Eric, thank you for being here.
No, thank you.
It was your grandfather that founded ArtCast, and interesting story. I'm just wondering at the beginning if we could just hear a little bit about how ArtCast came to be.
Well, my grandfather came over in, I think it was the very late 50s, and he was trained as a gardener in Germany and in Sweden, and he came over and was going to work in the greenhouses, but the pay just wasn't enough, so he ended up working in an industrial foundry in Brampton for a few years. He worked his way through that foundry, and him and two of his friends who were working there at the time, they split off and they started their own industrial foundry. And that was in 1964. And then in 1964, they started doing small art projects as well, because they were still learning the basics of using ceramic shell as a way to actually hold the metal when they were casting it. And that was one thing that was a proprietary process up until that point. Like, only certain foundries that were paying for the rights were able to use it. So they started developing that, and that's why they broke off into their own foundry. They then moved on to going into a little bit of artwork, because they could produce reliable castings for artists, because backyard foundries just couldn't produce the exact shape. Whereas doing stuff that was more aerospace had to be exact shape, exact size, and dimensionally stable and reliable castings. So they actually had to produce castings along those lines for industrial clients. And then when they were doing artwork, they were able to produce very similar results as well. And that's how we started in the art industry. Our first art casting was a small coin for Milton Hydroelectric. And it was a little 50 years for them in 1964. So we have that little coin in our library of little trinkets that we've cast over the years.
Right. But you've cast from that size to way larger.
We've done life-size monuments above life-size. There's a 10-foot version of a soldier. I can't remember if it's on Parliament Hill. I think it's somewhere in Ottawa. And I believe that artist is André Gauthier. And it's this soldier. The piece is called Au Revoir. And it's the soldier waving. And that was unveiled by, I can't remember which prime minister it was, but it was unveiled by the prime minister at the time. My opa got to meet him as well, and they were able to unveil this massive piece. It was 10 feet tall. The foot was like 2-3 feet long. It was huge.
So when you say your opa, that's your grandfather.
Yeah, my grandfather, and, German.
Eric Senior, and he actually escaped from Eastern Germany just before the wall went up.
Actually, yeah, earlier than that though. But he escaped East Berlin under the pretense that he was going for a bicycle race in I believe West Berlin.
Right.
And there's a story of him just sitting on the train with his friend who was also going across to West Berlin during that time period, and they're sitting on this train. They're just across the border. They think they're like on the home stretch, just ready to go. The train stops. Some soldiers get on, and they're everyone has to pull out their passports. Everyone's checking their visas, and it was apparently terrifying. Just that little bit of doubt that you'd make it across. But he made it. He was one of the 2.5 million that actually made it across the border from East to West Berlin during that time. And it was a crazy story to hear that from him. He left a brother behind. He left his family behind. He didn't tell anyone that he was leaving. He couldn't.
No.
It's just, you had to. And then after the wall came down, he went back and visited his brother.
After so many years.
He went back and tried to find his brother.
Right.
And he had to go back, and he was knocking on doors trying to figure out where people were. They had to go talk to the mayor at the time because everyone was paranoid because of Soviet rule at the time.
Right.
Or before then.
Yeah.
Just after the wall came down, because that was 89 when the wall came down.
Right.
So that's still pretty recent.
Yeah.
And he went back. He found his brother, and he had left this photo album, so it was a bit of a sentimental tearjerker when they met up again, which was pretty interesting to hear about. But yeah.
So he started really from scratch in a new country. And and when you were growing up, you did you hang around in the foundry and pick up some of that knowledge, or
A little bit.
Yeah.
I picked up more of the photography bug from my grandfather, just personal hobby-wise. But the passion for the foundry I got mainly from my grandfather, and just his pride in the company, the little things that he'd show me, and mm-hmm. being able to watch a casting day, watching them pour bronze into the ceramic shell, it's just, it's a beautiful experience.
Yes.
There's something so amazing about watching this bright, orange, powerful metal being poured into this ceramic shell,
yeah.
cooling down and becoming something beautiful
yeah.
as it becomes a chunk of artwork.
Mm-hmm.
Or,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And there are actually many, it's part, the pouring of the bronze is part of a whole process.
There's it's all one sorts of like other 8-10 steps.
Yes, depending. Yes. And what would you say are some of the challenges with with bronze casting and finishing?
The challenges with casting are, in the industrial world, it's easy to standardize and prepare yourself for certain problems that you can foresee
mm-hmm.
based off the geometry of a part.
Right.
But in the art world, artists are able to create these shapes that aren't really used in the industrial world.
Mm-hmm.
They're able to create things that have holes and undercuts in places where an industrial part never would.
Mm-hmm.
So we've had to gear our process. We can't really standardize, but we can kind of treat sculptures like just a panel. Like if we're doing a large sculpture and someone's got a dress, we treat that dress as a panel.
Yes.
So then we put our gating system on our standardized grid that we built, and then
yes.
we're able to put it through the process in sort of a standard way. Like the molten metal, depending on the thickness of the wall, will flow at different rates. We don't want it to have any defects from any part of the process. The
mm-hmm.
shell has to be properly cooled,
mm-hmm.
properly dried.
Yes.
And the wax has to be properly adhered so we don't have any defects from that part of the process,
mm-hmm.
then the shell has to be properly dried. We have to have the right amount of layers. It has to be preheated at the right temperature.
Mm-hmm.
We have to water check it sometimes because we get some materials. Like we've had to cast, we've directly cast leather, we've directly cast birch bark, we've directly cast plastics. Plastics aren't particularly fun to cast, but
mm-hmm.
we've done them.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been
so actually
able
taking
to,
actual
yeah.
objects and directly casting them.
Yep.
Like
actual up. Objects, actual
mm-hmm.
materials.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not super toxic,
mm-hmm.
and if we can incinerate it or melt it out, then
mm-hmm.
it can be cast directly.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, the birch bark canoe.
Mm-hmm. So like going back to what you were saying about the gating system, that is the system that allows the bronze to pour simultaneously into a lot of areas at once so that it's not...
the gating system allows the molten metal to flow into the mold cavity.
Yes.
When we get into the actual casting stage.
Yes.
The mold is made of a ceramic slurry.
Yes.
It's a hard ceramic material made up of about 5 or 6 different ingredients, proprietary,
mm-hmm.
of course.
Mm-hmm.
But it's 5 or 6 different ingredients, and it actually is designed to release from the from the cooled bronze.
Mm-hmm.
It's designed to produce the highest surface detail,
mm-hmm.
and it's designed to break away after the fact.
Right.
As well. So it's the strong outer shell that gets cracked away later with just a hammer and some handwork.
And then when it's cast, the gating system is cast as well.
Yeah,
so
all
then you
of
have
there.
To remove all the remove yeah. that from the object and then
yeah, we have to cut that
go
off.
To the finishing part
yep.
of the process.
Yeah, then we have to cut the gating system off. We then grind those points down where it was attached to the sculpture.
Mm-hmm.
We then, if it's on the outside, we will retexture the surface to match the surrounding texture.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll reassemble the sculpture if it was cast in multiple pieces. We'll then go through some finer finishing where we'll retexture welds. We'll add the final surface finish, whether it's a wire brush, sandblast, bead blast, or sometimes there's a polish as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll add the final finish, which is the patina,
mm-hmm.
the coloring on the top of it.
And the patina is also a protector of the bronze
yeah.
as well.
It is. So it's a chemical process to color the bronze.
Mm-hmm.
Think of it as like a rust, but more protective.
Yes.
It's not as corrosive as a rust is. The patina itself protects the surface. It soaks into the surface. It's a bit of a barrier because
mm-hmm.
once you have that oxide on the outer layer, it's more of a protector of the actual piece than just having a raw bronze.
Mm-hmm.
Once the patina's on there, just as another precaution as well, we seal it with a clear wax.
Mm-hmm.
And the clear wax protects A, the patina, B, the bronze. Protects against weather a little bit. Like a lot of the times pieces are indoor, but when they're outdoor, it protects against weather. It doesn't usually protect against salt, though.
Well, this is a sculpture is placed is pretty important in terms of the the elements outside.
Yeah, absolutely. We've had some pieces that have been placed in... We've got one piece on Center Island, for instance. Mm-hmm. And those pieces have aged gracefully. Like, they aren't turning bright green, which I personally do like the bright green that you get sometimes. Mm. Like, I love seeing the Henry Moores in town, like how those are aging where you can see the welds.
Yes.
It's not a mark of a great founder to see the welds, but things happen and things age differently. So it's not bad, and I like the character you get from it.
Right.
But these pieces on Center Island, they haven't had exposure to salt. They don't get exposure to the same rain and the same weather that we get downtown Toronto.
Right.
And they haven't had exposure to a lot of dust as well. So they're not getting sanded down by this sand and dust flying at it.
Right.
So their maintenance is pretty much just washing them down and resealing them with wax.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas we've had stuff in more northern Ontario where they have to brine the roads. And an entire one side of this whole sculpture was a bright, bright green.
Right.
Because they had brined the road. There's also a black spot on the trees where the brine was hitting them as well, like against that road. So we actually had to go there, wire brush them, clean them, try and get them down to at least close to the brown that they were originally, and seal it again with wax. That took three of us a whole day to try and fix that piece, whereas that one on Center Island takes three of us a couple hours just to quickly rinse them down.
So bronze casting is such a long history in for artists, and what is it about bronze that makes artists love it so much?
There's a permanence to it.
Yes.
There's a way to preserve the original artwork, whereas a plaster or like a concrete original, as they get a they definitely get a certain feel from them. There's definitely a good use for them as well. But there's not a lot of permanence. They end up in galleries, and they end up in galleries like the AGO, for instance, that spends I don't know how much on maintaining these plasters in the right conditions.
Yeah.
It's like paintings and sketches that have to be maintained because the paper is going to deteriorate over time. A bronze will turn green, a bronze will age, but we're finding stuff that's thousands and thousands of years old.
Yeah.
We're finding stuff that just has a bit of a discoloration to it. Take a bit of a polishing compound to it, and you can bring it back to its original shine. It's pretty it's a pretty amazing material, and there's this warmth that you get from it that you don't get from other materials.
And some artists now, contemporary artists who have been working with unusual materials, are actually having their work that they've made in as a more modern material cast in bronze.
Yeah. We're working with an artist right now, and they use a tin foil-like product.
Yes.
And so that works well for galleries, but they have a public art commission that they're doing right now, and they had to find a way to either stiffen up the material that they used or to work with a better material for the particular purpose of a public art piece.
Right.
So what they've done is they brought their tinfoil material to us. We did some sample castings. We did a sand casting, a process we call make hollow, and we did a direct cast where we didn't do anything to the shell in between.
Right.
And with that, when they decide that the make hollow process worked the best for them, and so we've been casting, there's over 160 different pieces, I believe, as part of that project. So these artists never thought they'd be working in bronze. They never thought they'd be going to a foundry.
No.
They actually found it difficult to have such a permanence to the piece, because what they've done with their work is they've been keeping a library, and they rebuild pieces and reimagine them into other pieces later on for gallery works.
And
so they're finding it just a little bit difficult for them to have such a permanence to their work.
Right.
But they're really enjoying it as well. They're loving the process. They love where it's going. And they feel that it's going to be an excellent piece. I believe it's going in Waterfront Toronto. I don't know exactly where.
Right.
But it's going somewhere there.
Huh. When you see a bronze sculpture in a public space, a large sculpture, you never think of, consciously think, but it's would be hollow usually.
Oh, and anything above the size of your fist is hollow, usually, depending on the way it's done. Sand castings, sometimes they're a little bit more solid, just the way it flows and the complications that can arise from trying to do a sand casting.
Right.
But if it's a larger monument, it's usually, either it's an investment casting or it's cast in panels and welded together.
Yes.
Well, it's always welded together, in a larger a larger piece. But depending on if it's sand casting or investment casting, it's still done in panels, it's still welded together at that size. But it's nothing like that size is ever solid.
But inside that hollow object, there is some kind of a structure. I remember...
Yeah, a lot of the time we built... or based off of engineer drawings, usually. An engineer mm-hmm. usually gets involved in public art pieces for yes. public safety.
Right.
And so there has to be... there are certain regulations that they have to follow where if something sticks out a certain amount from the piece,
right.
it has to hold... 2, 3, maybe even 4 300-pound people
right.
hanging off it all at the same time.
Yes.
So we've had to reinforce them with, I believe, stainless steel.
Yes.
Actually, yeah, stainless steel. It doesn't react with the bronze. It's a, it doesn't rust, or it doesn't corrode the same way that mild steel does.
Right.
And it's a much better material for our climate
mm-hmm.
because of its properties.
So some sculptures probably need repairs if that inner... structure is made out of something that rusts and deteriorates
well,
in our
of,
climate.
Yeah, there's a lot of older sculptures that have been mm-hmm. cast in Italy and Israel,
mm-hmm.
and those pieces have a milder, or I believe it's mild steel in them.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them also have what's called core material. So a lot of those sections were cast with a clay or plaster-like material on the inside,
right?
And that allows them to build those hollow outer shells. But leaving it in the piece is fine in a dry, hot environment.
Right.
In a Canadian environment, which is neither dry nor hot today, especially,
mm-hmm.
That material will start to seep out of the outside of it.
Uh-huh.
It'll produce cracks. If water gets inside of it, you have to make sure that there's water or drainage holes.
Mm-hmm.
You have to make sure that water doesn't stay anywhere in the piece.
Right.
Because as soon as you get a bit of ice in there, water's amazing. It's powerful. It can crack the epoxy that's holding something together. It can crack a bronze. It
mm-hmm.
can really wreak havoc on a public art piece,
mm-hmm.
just depending on how it holds water.
I know that there's a lot of monumental pieces in Ottawa, our nation's capital,
mm-hmm.
that you've cast and installed. And have you made things for other countries outside of Canada?
There's one public piece we have that I know is in... well, actually, it's on Juno Beach in Normandy,
mm-hmm.
in France.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Juno Beach Memorial. It's known as Remembrance and Renewal.
Right.
The artist is Colin Gibson. That was done 2005, 2006, in
mm-hmm.
that range.
Mm-hmm.
And the artist looked out a window, he saw a palm tree, and he got the inspiration for these figures sort of facing out in this sort of circular, rounded
mm-hmm.
Arrangement. They all have their helmets on, so they're all... no, well, they're all... soldiers
mm-hmm.
from
the First World War. The
yeah,
Second World War.
It was D-Day. It was the First World War.
Uh huh.
Yeah, so that was on Juno Beach in Normandy.
Yes.
So that's representative of Canada's role in that.
Right.
In D-Day.
Right.
So that piece went on there, and when they unveiled the Juno Beach Center.
Right.
There as well. So I haven't actually gotten a chance to go see it. My opa actually
mm-hmm.
was there at the unveiling.
Uh-huh,
so he got to go there. They flew a plane over, and they released thousands and thousands of poppies without the pins in them.
Mm-hmm.
So this plane went over, and there's this unveiling happening, a bunch of veterans talking about the First World War, dignitaries from
mm-hmm.
many, many countries,
mm-hmm.
and they're just sitting there, and these poppies are falling all around them, and it was apparently amazing. It was a beautiful sight. So
mm-hmm.
they've got this big green sculpture in the center,
mm-hmm.
these bright red poppies falling over everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something amazing.
Beautiful.
Amazing.
In the times that you have been working at ArtCast,
mm-hmm.
is there one project that is your favorite project that you've been involved in?
I don't really have favorite projects. There's some that I've had a bit more of a hand in than others. We did a project for George Brown College where I had a bit more of a hand in it because we were working with a bit more of a modern system. We had to have 3D printed originals.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that we tested out in the 20 years ago, but
mm-hmm.
it's not something we really had as a mainstream
mm-hmm.
Process yet. So we had to do a bit of research trying to find the right materials, the right companies to work with.
Mm-hmm.
But that was something I worked on a
mm-hmm.
little bit, so that was a bit more of a... that's one of my favorites, I
mm-hmm.
guess, but I don't really have a lot of major favorites. There's
right.
a lot of artists that I really like working with, and there's a lot of stuff like that, but I think our biggest piece that I've worked on since I started working at the Foundry
uh-huh.
is the 1812 memorial we did for Parliament Hill.
Right.
So Adrian Allison's the artist of that one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's on the east block, kitty corner to the National War Memorial.
Right.
And it was being installed the week before, or the week that the... it was being installed the week that the shooting happened at Parliament Hill. So that was
wow.
all around that time period. That was last year, November.
Yes. Yes. Very dramatic.
Yeah. Very dramatic. But it's an amazing piece to see if you're ever in Ottawa. Mm-hmm. I'd suggest taking a look.
Mm-hmm. I've seen photographs of it.
Yeah, it's a really cool piece. It's seven above life-sized figures mm-hmm. on these three stones. There's a 15-ton stone in the center, 2 7-ton stones on the side. There's a big bronze rope, which is full of stainless steel, by the way, mm-hmm. because it has to support 4 300-pound people standing on it.
Yes.
Where bronze will flex, mm-hmm. but it's not going to break, usually. Mm-hmm. And I highly doubt that 4 300-pound people are going to sit on the rope, but it's one of those things where the engineer got involved, and it worked out great. It looks amazing on mm-hmm. site, and it's mm-hmm. I'm glad it's there.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you mentioned 3D printing. That's how is that affecting the art casting world?
Well, 3D printing has been around in the industrial foundry world mm-hmm. since, the advent of 3D printing almost 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. The process called SLA, where they use a UV laser to cure a bath of resin mm-hmm. in various layers to produce a 3D file, has been around for about 20 years. And mm-hmm. we did a test when it first started coming to the industrial foundries. And like I said, we've been seeing it a little bit more recently because mm-hmm. Artists now have the capability to produce sculptures that don't have this threat of gravity pulling it apart as they're sculpting it. So they can produce things in a clay-like material on a computer. Uh-huh. And they can produce these geometries that we've never seen before, stuff that just isn't possible in the way we are used to producing things. So it's very interesting seeing what's coming out of there now, and there are castable materials, so we don't have to build molds off of things.
Right. So for example, you could do a 3D print. You could print out in wax.
There are waxes. There are resins. There's another material that we work with that's like a plexiglass, and it's glued together. And that product doesn't require support material.
Right.
So it's a very high resolution print. It doesn't require any post finishing. Uh-huh. They dip it in a wax. We get it, and it's good to go. It doesn't expand. It doesn't crack our shell. There's no real disadvantages except cost. 3D printing is still very expensive. But it's definitely something that we're seeing a lot more of now.
So do you think that 3D printing is going to change the art casting world?
I think it's going to change a lot more than just the art casting world. Mm-hmm. I think it's definitely going to. I don't think everyone's going to have one in their homes, but we're definitely going to be seeing more and more of it in our lives. Mm-hmm. Whether it's knee implants, for instance, they can do mass customizations. They've got a basic shape. Mm-hmm. And they can adjust the basics of it to fit whichever bone in your knee that they actually have to fit it to perfectly. Mm-hmm. So they don't have to have small, medium, large. They just replace exactly what needs to be replaced. And the mass customization thing, I think we're going to be seeing more and more of that in the art industry as well. Mm-hmm. With people coming to us with just an image and wanting either a relief or a sculpture of their family member that just has been deceased. Right. Or something along those lines. So it's definitely going to change the industries, but I also feel that it's going to be a tool that we're going to see more and more of with people who are sculpting and designing in 3D. They're going to be coming to us with more 3D files. Even in the last year, we've had 10 projects at least. Whether or not it's been something we've actually done in 3D or just had an inquiry about, it's been something that we've been seeing more and more of.
So they're, instead of coming to you with something that has been sculpted, they're coming to you, or
with
just even sending
sending
you a file, a 3D file.
Some people I haven't even seen, but I've been in contact with. I've had the file. It's been just approvals through photos and emails, and it's just been sent out. But it's not something that I feel should be feared. It's something I feel should be embraced, but I also don't want the imperfections from that process particularly to be embraced as artwork.
Right.
I would like to see a sculpture created through 3D to look like a sculpture that's been sculpted by hand. But with a bit of the impossibilities of sculpting by hand. It would be kind of interesting to see as well.
Well, I'm fascinated by the process and the results. I'm curious about patinas and style. Like, for example, there's sort of fashions that go in and out about bronze finishing. Some patinas are in style.
Well, like 60s and 70s, we were seeing a lot of polish. Mm-hmm. I'm not an art historian by any means, but just observing what we've seen come through the shop, there's still artists that really like their polish. They're
yes.
generally on the older side. They're generally ones who are producing a lot more in the 70s.
Right.
And then we were seeing a lot more of the pastel colors coming through after that era as well, like the bright greens, the bright blues.
Uh-huh.
And right now, in monuments, and smaller sculpture, people are just generally going with the basic liver ferric, which is that sort of reddish brown.
Right.
Every once in a while, we'll see somebody do something along the burgundy side or along the green and blue side,
uh-huh.
seeing where things go. But it's getting very, it's going back to the traditional bronze brown color
yes.
at this point.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, but it's still, you still get an excellent feel, and it becomes fine art once it becomes bronze in a way.
Yes.
So we've also, you saw the, I believe when you were in the shop, you mm-hmm. saw the walking stick. Mm-hmm. It was just a chunk of driftwood that we brought in, we cast solid,
mm-hmm.
so it's 40 pounds of bronze,
mm-hmm.
and then we did what's called a silver nitrate patina on it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's got, there's a grayish silver tone to it, and it's very cool.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives a completely different feel, like you wouldn't think that it was bronze when looking at it, and it's just this heavy chunk of grayish silver
mm-hmm.
Material, and it's got a completely different feel than something that has that brown.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah,
and the patina becomes part of the piece. It's
absolutely,
not
a patina can make or break
service.
A piece. Yeah.
Yes, I
and,
think.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But no, it's not. Some of them do have pigments in them. Some of them are a bit more durable for outside. Some
yes.
of them are a lot better for indoor pieces. You generally can't go wrong if it's staying indoors, but. Some of them get a better feel under fluorescent lighting, some of them get a better feel under incandescent lighting, but when you have just that standard rich reddish brown liver ferric, that generally goes well in any light,
mm-hmm.
and it's a durable patina for outdoors as well.
Right. So for an artist, working with the patina, the person mm-hmm. who does
the
patina,
patiner or master patiner, as we
master
call it.
Patiner.
Yeah,
they would be on the side of an artist. I mean, they would be mm-hmm. an artist in it's an art.
Well, the
form
entire process is an art form in itself,
mm-hmm.
and within that, the wax making it, like being able to produce somebody else's work.
Yes,
being able to do it in their style,
mm-hmm.
and as a technician, but it's still an art form within itself. Being able to produce a mold, a good mold,
yes.
that doesn't have a lot of issues and has very minimal parting line, if possible, is an art form in itself.
Yes.
Building a shell, building that ceramic shell, I personally can't do it,
mm-hmm.
but the person we've had doing it, he's been in the shop for almost 30 years, 30 years next year, actually.
Wow.
And building that shell perfectly is an art form,
mm-hmm.
being able to pour. And when you get to patina, that really can make or break a piece.
Yes.
There's some artwork out there, like you can tell, like I'm not going to say it's a bad thing, but you can tell when something's done by usually a student. A student has access usually to a liver patina, which is sulfurated potash and water.
Mm-hmm.
So that's that yellow rock-like stuff you see at volcanoes.
Mm-hmm.
They usually have access to what's called M20 and M38, which are chemicals that are for antique black and antique brown.
Mm-hmm.
So they're cold. They can be done at room temperature, but you don't have to heat up the metal for them. And they can be, like, without, you just generally get a basic wash over the piece. You don't
right.
usually get a lot of depth. You can achieve some by sanding it back with different materials and stuff along those lines, but when it comes to getting a lot of depth in a patina, it takes somebody who's had experience doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, that comes from an art school, it's not a bad thing. They're learning still, which is good, but it's generally a bit matte and flat.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that works, but it's a lot of the time you can tell what's been done by a professional
mm-hmm.
and somebody who's still learning. But it's always good to see people who are still learning, because it is becoming a bit of a lost art form, casting
yes.
in bronze, unfortunately.
Yes. And
yeah.
so as an artist, if you are having work cast, you would probably want to have a direct connection
yeah.
with the master patinor.
Yeah.
Right.
It's definitely something it's always fun to watch, too.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we usually suggest when people are unsure what they want to come in and work with the patinor on the process.
Right.
Because our patiner doesn't exactly know what you're particularly thinking unless he's worked with you many,
yes.
many times.
Yeah.
A lot of the times he's able to produce something that everyone loves, but it's just working with him gives you a better understanding of why some things take a little bit longer or why the cost is what it is for some things as
mm-hmm,
well.
Mm-hmm.
Because that process can take a couple hours, it can take a full day,
mm-hmm.
depending on what's involved, because sometimes it has to be heated up to do the first layer, And then you can do the second layer when it's cool, or if you're doing some of the brighter colors where you're achieving like the... We've got one that's got a bit of a white to it. We've got the brighter greens and the brighter blues. Mm-hmm. Those require cold wax. So once everything's on there, that has to cool down. Mm-hmm. And depending on the size, that can take all day.
Right.
So he may have to do things the next day as well.
Right.
But it's a labor-intensive process, but it's definitely a lot of fun. I've been playing around with patina a little bit myself.
Right.
I'm having definitely a good time with that.
And to know that you can use multiple colors.
Oh, absolutely. Well. Yeah, like being able to have a bit of liver ferric over here, having just the base coat as one color, and then being able to apply a bit of green over here, a bit of blue on the shoe, mm-hmm. for instance, or having an entire one side of it more of a black, having a silver on a different thing. But it definitely takes a lot of skill to be able to apply those types of patinas perfectly,
right.
The way we've been able to achieve. So.
Wow. Well, Eric, thank you very much for giving us a little window into the art casting process. Eric Knossel from ArtCast, thank you again.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.